Outside the fortified courthouse in Minneapolis, the Floyd family lawyer, Benjamin Crump, declared the trial a test of American justice system and said that the world is watching. Today starts a landmark trial that would be a referendum on how far America has come in its quest for equality and justice for all, he said. A group of protesters held signs that read, "Minneapolis will never forget George Floyd," and "Mr. George Floyd is not on trial, Derek Chauvin is." Jerry Blackwell showed the jury a 9-minute and 29-second video of Derek Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck, the footage that had shocked millions of Americans last year and prompted the huge racial justice protest that swept the United States and beyond. "You can believe your eyes that it was homicide. It was murder," he told the jury, some of whom had not seen the video before. In the recording, George Floyd can be heard saying 20 times that he could not breathe and 10 times that he was dying. He repeatedly called out for his dead mother. Jerry Blackwell said that the dying man can also be heard to say, "Tell my kids I love them and I'll probably die this way. I'm through, I'm through. They're going to kill me." Blackwell said that George Floyd was no longer breathing for the last minute that Derek Chauvin was kneeling on his neck. The prosecutor said that the police officer not only failed to fulfill his legal duty to help George Floyd, but stopped anyone else from assisting him, including a firefighter trained in first aid. Blackwell said that even when Derek Chauvin was told by a paramedic that George Floyd no longer had a pulse, the police officer kept his knee in place. "You'll see that he does not let up. He does not get up. Even when Mr. Floyd does not even have a pulse, it continues on," he said. He said the jury will hear testimony from a police officer who arrived on the scene while George Floyd was held down, who will say that at that point there was no need for the force used by Derek Chauvin. The prosecutor also said that the Minneapolis police chief, Medaria Arredondo, who fired Derek Chauvin shortly over George Floyd's death, will testify that the former police officer's conduct was not consistent with Minneapolis Police Department training or protocol. "He will tell you it's excessive force," Blackwell said. The prosecutor said that George Floyd's arrest was unnecessary in the first place, as passing a counterfeit bill, even if intentional, is a misdemeanor for which the police could have written a ticket. Derek Chauvin's lawyer Eric Nelson said in his opening statement that he will show that his client's behavior was reasonable under the circumstances because George Floyd was under the influence of drugs at the time of his arrest. He said witnesses testified that George Floyd had taken opioid pills shortly before he was detained and that at times he passed out. The evidence will show that when confronted by police, Mr. Floyd put drugs in his mouth in order to conceal them from police, he said. Eric Nelson said that George Floyd took a speedball of opioids and methamphetamine and that as a result he was struggling violently against arrest, which necessitated use of force. Derek Chauvin did exactly what he had been trained to do over his 19-year career, he said. The outcome of the trial may well center on the cause of death. Eric Nelson said medical evidence will show the presence of drugs as well as other medical issues including coronary heart disease and an enlarged heart were the cause of death. He said there is no medical evidence of asphyxiation. The official autopsy and an independent autopsy at the time concluded that the main cause of death was homicide. Jerry Blackwell said this was not a heart attack. The first prosecution witness was a 911 dispatcher, Jenna Scurry, who told the police supervisor she was concerned at seeing the police officers sat on this man in a live feed from a street camera. Blackwell said of Jenna Scurry's testimony that she called the police on the police. Later in the afternoon, prosecution witness Donald Williams, a 33-year-old, told how he watched George Floyd slowly fade away from close by, even as bystanders implored and berated the police officer holding him. Donald Williams told the court that he could hear and see George Floyd in distress, and his martial arts experience indicated to him that Derek Chauvin was choking out George Floyd as he kneeled on his neck. The jury and the public watching in court or around the world by live stream was shown some devastating clips of Derek Chauvin allegedly shimmying in what Williams said was a martial arts move, altering his position very slightly so that it put more pressure on, as a fighter does when they have someone in a hold. Williams heard George Floyd talking about how much pain he was in, his distress as he said he couldn't breathe, apologized to the police officers and begged for his life. The more that the knee was on his neck and the shimmying going on, the more you see him, Floyd slowly fading away. His eyes rolled to the back of his head, Williams said. He described Floyd dying like a fish in a bag. Williams described the knee position as a dangerous blood choke intended to cut Floyd's airway. Williams has previously been heard but unseen shouting angrily at the police officer from the sidewalk, calling Derek Chauvin a bum and accusing him of enjoying what he was doing as George Floyd suffers and begs. The trial continues.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing National Bird, directed by German filmmaker Sonja Kennebeck. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him, we have Dan Glazebrook, who's a journalist, political analyst, and author of the book Divide and Ruin, The West's Imperial Strategy in an Age of Crisis. Now, National Bird follows the harrowing journey of three US military veteran whistleblowers determined to break the silence surrounding the US's secret drone war. Tortured by guilt for their participation in the killing of faceless so-called suspects abroad, and despite the threats of being prosecuted, these three veterans offer an unprecedented look inside this secret program to reveal the haunting cost of the US's global drone strikes.
Maybe we killed our objective, maybe we killed a guy who we thought was our objective. We don't know.
When I first got into the military and I was thinking it was a force for good in the world, I thought I was going to be on the right side of history, and today I don't believe I was.
I still have a top secret clearance, so I have to be extraordinarily cautious about what I can and can't say on camera.
My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, and identify everything.
Adolescent near the rear of the SUV.
That's deceptive. You get the opinion that you're at 10,000 feet, you see this photograph, you know what's going on. You don't know what's going on. You know what you see in two dimensions.
You see someone die because you said it was okay to kill them.
It's too easy. They just embolden commanders.
Thunder's in, but the party began.
Because there is no threat.
Oh, sweet talking.
I mean, this could grow to get so out of control.
Somebody downstairs was knocking at the door, and immediately both people at the door shoved FBI badges in my face.
The
The Espionage Act is one of the most serious charges you can level against an American.
That I'm probably going to get indicted and I'm probably going to get charged.
I lost part of my humanity working in the drone program. It's a secret program. I can't just go telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, it's frightening.
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Sonia Kennebec, the director, she won an award for this documentary with the Nation Institute. And she said in her award acceptance speech that she initially set out to make this documentary solely just about drones and drone warfare, but then it developed into something much more than this. Of course, we learn of the stories of the three characters in the documentary, and she wanted to focus also on the consequences of whistleblowing and espionage and all these sorts of issues. And Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, you can always tell there's something in the air, both literally and figuratively in this case, when filmmakers start making films about the same kind of thing. So in recent years, we've had three or four movies on the subjects of drones. We've had this, we've had the documentary called Drone, which is a slightly more arty and abstract version of this story. But we've also had feature films like Good Kill with Ethan Hawke as a drone pilot and Eye in the Sky, a British film with Alan Rickman and Helen Mirren. So there's clearly something going on that filmmakers, they want to be a part of this conversation. And I think part of the situation is that we are still all, we're all making our way through this moral maze at the moment. We're all dealing with the ramifications of drone technology. We're trying to figure out what the consequences are, the good points and the bad points. And I think filmmakers like Sonia Kennebec here, they all want to have a say in that conversation.
And of course, as you said, there's been a resurgence in this topic of drone warfare and the moral obstacles around it. And we've had, this documentary had Wim Wenders as the executive producer, of course, is a multi-winning, award-winning German filmmaker. How much impact do you think he had in this documentary?
Well, he's one executive producer, and he, you know, the inventors in the past has had an interest in surveillance technology. He made a very interesting film at the end of the last century called The End of Violence, which is about surveillance technology in America as it was back then, and obviously things have moved on very rapidly from that. The other executive producer is Errol Morris, who is, you know, a revered documentarian, and has made things like The Fog of War in the past, so he himself is also very interested in this subject matter. So it obviously helps a young up-and-coming filmmaker when you can get two great filmmakers, two revered filmmakers within the industry to put their names on the credit of the film. And, you know, it all ties in with some of the work they've done in the past.
And Dan, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on National Bird?
Well, I thought it was interesting, but to be honest, I find this quite often with films on this subject, the tendency to focus on the emotional turmoil of the operators and really the perpetrators, I find, to be honest, slightly distasteful, really, given that the primary victims, obviously, of drone warfare are the people getting blown up and getting their legs blown off and so on. And they do feature in the film, and they have quite an extended section in Afghanistan talking to the victims, but you never get the feeling that they get the same full kind of personhood ascribed to them by the filmmaker. You don't see this sort of rich emotional life that's depicted of the operators and the perpetrators, and I feel like that's actually is playing into the hands of the dehumanization that allows things like the drone program to exist. Because yes, Afghans are in the film, but they're really there just as victims who you know kind of walk around and then get bombed. There's no real feel of what it's like for them, what their lives are like. So I find it difficult.
I see your point, Dan, but one could argue that the role of whistleblowers and journalists, of course, shine a light on these issues, otherwise that would be ignored. And I think Sonia probably emphasizes this in the documentary.
Absolutely, and you know, that what they've done to come out against the program is commendable. But I think even to kind of do justice, if you like, to the operators depicted in the film themselves, you know, what turned them against what they're doing is that at some point they had a realization, my God, these are human beings that I'm killing. They're just like me or my mom or my neighbor. And I don't think that realization that's led to them being racked by guilt is fully given to us as a viewer. And I think that's problematic.
I was an imagery analyst and a screener. My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, the live video, of course, and identify everything. Another remote duty station, you'd have the pilot, of course, who's flying the actual aircraft, and the sensor operator who is moving the camera around. They were the ones that actually push the button. I do not push the button. I just identify what necessitates a button pushing. We can't just bomb someone and fly away. We have to follow through. The bomb hit and wait for it to cool down a little bit, and then you can see, like, the body parts. You can identify, like, that could be the lower half of his body, and that could be a leg. And then sometimes you'll stick around and watch family come and get them, or, like, pick up the parts and put their family member in a blanket, and a couple people hold onto a corner of the blanket and carry him back to their compound.
So you really feel for her in this documentary. Indeed, the other characters also, but she seems to come across as the one most plagued and crippled by guilt for her role in the drone program. Mike, what do you make of how her character is portrayed?
Well, she's not a million miles away from the Ethan Hawke character in Good Kill, the feature film that came out a couple of years ago, in that, you know, she was very much in the room watching this footage come in. And the sense that I got from her watching this film is that it's very different from being a soldier on the ground. If you're a soldier on the ground, you know pretty much that you've killed someone if you haven't killed someone. The sense that I get from her, the issues that she's working through are connected to the fact that nobody has told her who she's killed, how many people she's killed. This is hanging over her, and you get a sense of this issue bearing down on her. It's like she's got something over her head. And that is a very powerful thing.
And Dan, I know you say the true victims are, of course, the targets of the drone strikes. But in this documentary, you see Heather and the others almost come across as victims in their own right, and perhaps particularly connected to the US military's recruitment campaigns. I mean, it's sold off, as you see, as a glorious sort of career you could have, and that you're on the right side of history and justice. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
Oh, certainly. They are victims as well. They're, I mean, secondary victims, I would say, but certainly. I mean, they're recruited into it pretty much as children, and to talk about the majority of drone operators being 18 to 24. So they're recruited at 18, practically children, but they'll be kind of groomed effectively from 16, 17. If you think about the involvement of the Pentagon with the video games industry, they're really being groomed from the age of whenever they start playing video games, 8, 7, 6, into this, into this role. So it's really, it is a form of institutional child abuse within America, you know, what America is doing to its own children, and here in this country, in Britain as well, same thing. Certainly, and of course they're sold, as you say, the idea of being on the right side of history. One of the people involved in the program said,
they had this real sense of moral righteousness, and that they set out to do the right thing. Yeah. They had good intentions at heart.
Exactly, but it's, it is child abuse, and you see the impact, and the fact that they're not even allowed to talk to therapists because the therapists don't have security clearance. So the other thing that they would want to discuss is classified, and so on. So absolutely, the treatment of them by the military is shocking. And you hear testimony from Heather in the film that her kind of commanding officers were constantly questioning her judgment. She was saying, I think there's women and children here, and so on, and they're saying, are you sure? I don't think so, let's fire anyway, and being overruled and so on. Absolutely, there's, you know, they are victims as well. I just don't think they're the primary victims.
That's a good point. And Mike, I just really quickly want to talk about the shots that are used in this documentary. You see a lot of aerial shots. And do you think the director did this intentionally to give the Western viewer the sense of what it's like to be watched? Because a lot of the shots are in US sort of suburban areas.
Yeah, I mean, the film sort of flips on its head halfway through, and we get a sense that the people who have been employed as watchers are now the watched. And that is very much there in all those drone shots over American cities, American towns. Drones have revolutionized the way movies in general have been made, because now it's much cheaper to do aerial shots rather than hiring big bulky crane equipment. You can just fly a plane or fly a drone above people's heads. So that has changed as well, and I think that's one of the reasons why we're seeing so many films on this subject. The technology, the form and the content are married in this respect.
It's a really interesting point, and I think one of the strengths of the documentary is it shows how barbaric and brutal drone strikes are. And Mike, if I could ask you, what did you make of this journey to Afghanistan and this story?
I liked it very much. I mean, we see so many documentaries that set out their case in the first hour and then spend the second hour driving home the same points over and over again. Here, I think you get a sense of a story developing in real time. There was a sense that this technology has been thrust upon us, and like I say, we're all making and negotiating our way through this moral maze. And when it does finally get to Afghanistan, you get a sense there, from that clip, the plane comes over, of just how normalized this kind of life has been. I mean, the fact it's called National Bird, would suggest that the drone has now become part of the natural order of things, part of the landscape for so many people, in ways both good and terrifying.
That's a really interesting point. And Dan, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Mike just said? What did you make of the journey to Afghanistan in this documentary?
Well, I was glad they included it, because about 40 minutes into the film, I thought, are we going to hear anything from any Afghans whatsoever? And they did spend an extended period of time in Afghanistan. But as I said, I still didn't feel really they came across fully as agents. They were still depicted as, they were shown as suffering and as victims, but they're portrayed as only victims, as kind of passive recipients, really, of US air power. There was no agency there. No narrative, no Afghan narrative was present, and there was no politics whatsoever in the film. And I think there's a real danger. The Glasgow Media Group had a really interesting study out a few years ago on the Palestine-Israel conflict, and they found that a lot of journalists were quite sympathetic to the Palestinians, but they knew that they weren't really allowed in Western media to actually put forward a Palestinian narrative about resistance to occupation and so on. So instead of that, in place of that, they just parade this endless parade of Palestinian suffering, but overlain with an Israeli narrative to justify it. Mm-hmm. And I think the danger, by not giving any kind of Afghan narrative, we just see, okay, we see the Afghan suffering, but there's no narrative, there's no other side of the story. The danger is that you have the same thing with the Palestine-Israel conflict, which people have pity for the Palestinians, but the overall view in the West, whenever Israel attacks, is, well, it's a sort of necessary evil in the war against terrorism. It's terribly sad, and we pity them, but it kind of has to be done. And I think there's a danger this film will have the same effect. People feel sorry for the Afghans, they'll pity them, but won't necessarily just see, oh, it's a shame these innocent bystanders die and so on, but that's kind of necessary.
Mike, so would you have liked to see more political context to this documentary?
There's certainly scope for a more comprehensive and possibly slightly drier documentary about drone technology and the politics of deployment. I mean, this is not a film about the systemic application of drone technology. It's not about the technological specifics of it. It is a human story, and those are the documentaries that tend to get sold at international marketplaces, play at festivals these days, because they're very easy to relate to. Mm-hmm. I still think we're in the early days, the early days of this technology, and there will be a more comprehensive documentary than the ones that we've seen so far. But in terms of a primer of how this affects both the watched and the watchers, I thought it was pretty solid.
Well, thank you for that point.
This is global. This is getting information anywhere at any time, shooting people from anywhere at any time, and it's not just one person sitting there with a little remote control, a little joystick, moving around a plane that's halfway across the world. That's not all there is. It's like borders don't matter anymore, and there's a huge system that spans the globe that can just suck up endless amounts of your life, your personal data. I mean, this could grow to get so out of control. And we're not the only ones that have this. This is going to be commonplace, if it's not already. It's a secret program. And what that means is that I can't just go shouting off the hilltops telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, one person who worked within this massive thing, it's frightening.
So Mike, like in the documentary, we hear from President Obama give a televised speech talking about the drone warfare operation. And he says how it operates in such a way to ensure minimal loss of life and that they're precise and surgical strikes. Of course, in the documentary, we learn that it isn't really that precise. And Daniel even says, one of the characters, that an element of guesswork is involved. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes, I mean, everyone does seem to be operating in some kind of grey area. I mean, we've seen from the clips that actually the images that the drones beam back to the operators in America are very fuzzy. I mean, there's a degree of ambiguity in those very images, never mind in the ethics of using this technology. And so what's interesting is what the film says about the way this technology has been sold to us. So it's clearly been sold to young army recruits as an exciting new development of the war on terror, and we see the adverts in the films that are all, they are like an advert for a computer game, as you say. But there's also a degree to which you think someone must have sold President Obama on this, that this is a new, clean way of killing, that you're killing, you're somehow keeping killing at arm's length, but you're still getting dirty hands. And I think this is something that all the people in the film are wrestling with.
Mm. Now, Dan, I think many people would be surprised to find that actually there were 10 times more strikes during President Obama's presidency than under George W. Bush's predecessor. What do you make of Obama's role in the drone warfare?
Well, on the one hand, drone warfare is a kind of terrifying, dystopian kind of future brought into the present. But at the same time, that shouldn't blind us to the fact that it is driven by desperation on the part of the Western powers. They tried big ground operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the fallout in terms of blood and treasure was so great that they just are not in a position to do that again. Mm-hmm. The Colin Powell said the U.S. Army is just about broken by Iraq. So they don't have that option. So when you say, was Obama, who sold Obama on this idea? Well, the reality was he didn't, if he wanted to continue making war, and there's a whole systemic pressure to do so within the U.S. government apparatus, then, the former options have been ruled out. Mm. It's no longer feasible to have these mass ground scale operations.
Like in the Vietnam War, over 50,000 U.S. personnel died.
Right.
And this was one of the factors that led to pressure the government to pull out.
Yeah.
But do you think if they had drones at the time that they would just have an endless war?
Well, this is an interesting question, isn't it? And quite feasibly, yeah, because it was the body bag coming home from Vietnam that drove the pressure to end the war. You're right. With mm-hmm. drones, there's no U.S. body bags. There's only Afghan body bags. Mm-hmm. And then there's obviously mental health fallout. Well, it's interesting, the U.S. casualties do exist. Heather talked about three of her friends on the drone program committing suicide. Mm-hmm. But of course, that doesn't have this generate the same headlines as a coffin coming home draped in a flag.
And a final say to you, Mike, would you recommend this documentary?
I think it's certainly worth watching. I think, this is one of those technologies that is that has proliferated very quickly. And like I say, we're all still wrestling with the ramifications of it, the consequences of it. It's not a bad place to start. I still think there'll be a more comprehensive documentary some years down the line.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for your insight. And that's all the time we have for this episode of Doc Review. And thank you again to both my guests and to you. And feel free to make suggestions about documentaries that you would like us to review. I've been Camilla Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Florida's proposed anti-protest legislation has provoked opposition across the U.S., says Kenny Stancil Ryder in an article published under the heading, Shameful, Florida House Passes GOP's Anti-Protest Bill. Stay tuned for more. Decrying the passage of House Bill 1 in the Florida legislature recently, the state's ACLU chapter warned that if the undemocratic anti-protest bill pushed by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis is passed by the state Senate and signed into law, it would silence and criminalize people who want to exercise their First Amendment rights to peacefully advocate for social change. It is shameful that this bill has passed into the House. Mika Kubik, executive director of the ACLU of Florida, said in a statement recently, It is clear certain legislators are more interested in earning political points with the governor than upholding the constitutional rights of their constituents. We've said it before and will state it again, Kubik continued. This bill is not intended to increase public safety. It is not intended to address any public need. Over 95% of protests across the state of Florida have been peaceful, unquote. Kubik noted that HB 1 and its companion bill, Senate Bill 484, represent a blatant attempt to silence and criminalize a speech that runs counter to the political agendas of those currently in power in Florida. It is a political stunt designed by Governor DeSantis that will further cultivate the disparate justice we've seen administered in Florida for years, he added. It is a rebuke of a year of historic expression where millions of people joined together to protest the continued killings of black people at the hands of police. As Common Dreams reported earlier this year, progressives have been sounding the alarm that Republican lawmakers in multiple states are exploiting the deadly January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol by a mob of then-President Donald Trump supporters to push for anti-protest bills, which critics say have nothing to do with stemming the tide of far-right extremism and everything to do. It's suppressing left-wing dissent and quashing protests against police brutality, fossil fuel pipelines, and more. In an op-ed published earlier this year, Irvin Chemerinsky, dean of the UC Berkeley School of Law, and Nozi Naziana, counsel at Protect Democracy, argued that Florida's bill would use the tragic events to dress in sheep's clothing DeSantis' wolfish intent to become the arbiter of free speech. In Florida, Trump ally DeSantis promoted HB 1 and SB 484 punitive proposals that critics say are meant to repress Black Lives Matter and other social justice protests on January 6th, the same day insurrectionists were storming the Capitol, as journalist Christopher Cook pointed out earlier this year. Journalist Ileana Higana wrote at the time that DeSantis used the riots in Washington, D.C., attended by several new Confederates, as a pretext to make taking down Confederate status a felony in Florida. As the ACLU of Florida explained, HB1 would send people to prison for up to 15 years for pulling down a Confederate flag or other shrines to white supremacy. It would subject any person present at any gathering that became violent through no fault of their own to felony charges, potentially leading up to 5 years in prison and the loss of their voting rights, even if the individual did not engage in any violent and disorderly conduct among their provisions. It would also protect violent counter-protesters from civil liability for injuring or killing a protester with their vehicle. According to an analysis of the legislation by the Florida Policy Institute, HB1 would expand the size of the state's carceral system, costing taxpayers millions of dollars while depriving residents of fundamental rights. Kubik pointed out that this political stunt will disproportionately harm black and brown Floridians who seek justice in the state. As Chemerinsky and Nozzi explained, the bill would also eliminate the authority of local governments to issue some of their own permits for protests and demonstrations and create civil liability for cities that do not use aggressive law enforcement tactics to crack down on demonstrations. Provisions like this, they added, deliberately strike at the heart of what it means to live in the U.S. democracy. The Intercept's Aline Brown and Akla Lacey have argued that the GOP's push for new anti-protest bills around the U.S. reflects an attempt to rebrand earlier anti-democratic efforts to crack down on dissent, taking advantage of outrage over the right-wing attack on the Capitol to undermine demonstrations for progressive causes. Florida's HB1 and SB 484 remain highly unpopular. According to a poll conducted by Florida Politics, 63% of the state's voters view the legislation unfavorably. State Representative Andrew Learned told the news outlet that his office had received 14,000 emails on the measure, and only 6 of those emails were in support. In an op-ed published earlier this week, Jale Johnson, an at-large city commissioner in Gainesville, argued that Governor DeSantis wants to undermine our ability to hold our government accountable. She urged state lawmakers to reject the bills, which attack collective right to protest and use preemption to block local leaders from doing jobs. The people of this great state have a fundamental right to free assembly. Our freedoms are non-negotiable, Johnson added. There is no harm from allowing people to march freely, peacefully, and unperturbed. But there is harm when our governor ignores the crises right in front of him in favor of pursuing legislation that undermines our local power and silences our voices, unquote. Florida's proposed anti-protest legislation has also provoked opposition across the U.S. In a letter addressed to State House Speaker Chris Sprouse and State Senate President Wilton Simpson, more than 100 law professors throughout the U.S. denounced HB1 and SB 484, characterizing the bills as unconstitutional and morally unconscionable. In his statement, Kubik said that giving those in power the ability to quash dissent is perilous, extremely unwise, and profoundly un-American. And yet, that is what Governor DeSantis and certain legislators are attempting to do. It is now up to the Senate, he added, to heed the voices of Floridans, uphold their duty to the Constitution, and stop this bill from ever becoming law.
Facebook has once again shut down the page of Press TV News Network, this time permanently, in yet another attack by the U.S.-based social media giant on Iranian media outlets. Facebook said in a note that this decision is irreversible. The company attempted to shut down Press TV's account without giving any prior warning. Facebook justified the act by claiming that Press TV has failed to follow the Facebook community standards. However, the company did not specify the so-called violations of its rules. The social media platform has, on a number of occasions, attacked Press TV, despite its own claim of providing space for freedom of expression. One such attack took place in mid-January, when Facebook temporarily deleted Press TV's page, which had more than 4 million followers. The news outlet, however, had its page restored after appealing the platform's decision to remove it. The attack coincided with Press TV's coverage of post-election violence in the U.S. Press TV has repeatedly fallen victim to censorship, not just on Facebook, but also on other fronts, including Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Over the past years, Facebook, along with other mentioned companies, have repeatedly targeted Press TV, among other media outlets of Iran, and the countries critical of the West and the Israeli regime's occupation of Palestine. It appears that the UK has also followed the footsteps of the US when it comes to censoring media. The UK broadcast regulator Ofcom recently stripped the Chinese media company of operating on its cable network, an exact move that it did to Iran's Press TV back in 2012.
I think we need to recognize that in today's day and age, the various social media, in particular we're talking about Facebook today, is being weaponized in the tools of the Western powers to actually try and make sure that the agendas that Western powers have are going to be promoted, and anyone that is resisting or saying different things to what the Western powers want to hear and want other people to hear outside, they're going to try and make sure that those voices are suppressed.
In June 2020, Facebook labeled Iran's Press TV, Russia's Sputnik, and China's Xinhua news agency as state media, saying that it would block them from running advertisements in the U.S., which views the three countries as its arch enemies. The state media labels did not apply to the BBC, Deutsche Welle, or other government-funded Western news agencies, nor to those accounts funded by the U.S. government, such as Radio Free Europe. That is a clear case of double standards. Facebook had in 2018 targeted hundreds of accounts that it claimed were tied to Iran and Russia under the pretext of fighting misinformation campaigns. While American social media platforms do not hesitate to silence the voice of Iranian media under the pretext of policy violations, they offer a free hand to anti-Muslim hate groups and Iranophobes under the banner of freedom of expression in a blatant double standard policy.
I think the idea of freedom of speech within the Western world is something that has been promoted by the Western powers, and it's a myth. When you look at the detail of what's actually going on in terms of what people are able to articulate and the parameters within which they're actually allowed to operate, what you see is that whatever the flavor of the month is, whatever the fashion is in terms of the political fashion about what should and should not be said, then if anyone goes outside of those parameters or criticizes things that are outside of those parameters that Western powers want to have criticized, and they will not allow that.
Facebook and other Western social media networks have repeatedly attacked Iranian news networks like Press TV and Hispan TV. Yet their allegations have been baseless. Therefore, there's a clear case of double standards. Western media cannot stand those who are critical of their policies, those who speak the truth, and of those who are the voice of the voiceless, as Press TV's slogan goes.
Friday, thousands of Yemenis rallied across the country to show their support for the popular Ansarullah movement and reiterate their strong resistance in the face of the devastating Saudi-led military campaign as the Yemen war entered its seventh year. People from all walks of life gathered in Sabine Square in central Sanaa since the early hours of Friday morning, waving the red, white, and black national flags. They chanted slogans against Saudi Arabia, which leads the military coalition against Yemen, and denounced U.S. support for it. Yemenis say the seventh year of the war will mark a departure from the rest, as the army has ramped up its retaliatory attacks against Saudi targets and made significant advances against Saudi-backed mercenaries. The recent spate of attacks seems to have had an impact on Saudi's policy in Yemen. Last week, Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud presented a so-called peace initiative to end the conflict in Yemen, which would include reopening Sana'a's airport and allowing fuel and food imports through Hodeidah port, both of which are under the control of Ansarullah movement. The Ansarullah movement, however, dismissed the plan as fruitless unless the war ends and the years-long siege on Yemen is lifted.
It does appear that Saudi Arabia is attempting to withdraw. It has lost, of course, significant support from the United States for its war effort. So the fact that it has requested another ceasefire, although this is one that has been mentioned in the past unsuccessfully, but the fact they're bringing it up again at this time does indicate that Saudi Arabia sees that it is in a never-ending war that it cannot win.
Yemen says it will press on with its attacks until the other side puts an end to its aggression.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The announcement raised hopes that Saudi hostilities against Yemen would end soon, but even that couldn't stop the Saudis from keeping up their onslaught on the war-ravaged country. While former U.S. President Donald Trump maintained close relationships with Saudi officials, including Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and provided Riyadh with abundant support, his predecessor, Barack Obama, wasn't free from blame either, as the Yemen war broke out during his administration when Joe Biden was serving as the vice president. Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and its other regional allies, launched a devastating military campaign on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Riyadh-backed former President Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi's government back to power and crushing the popular Ansarullah movement. That goal has not been fulfilled thanks to the resistance put up by Ansarullah throughout 6 years of indiscriminate war and blockade. What Saudi Arabia assumed to be a short conflict turned to an all-out war, killing hundreds of thousands and displacing millions.
The U.S. has always been as guilty as the Saudis because it has supported the war. It has provided Saudi Arabia with billions of dollars of weaponry, which has been used to slaughter the Yemeni people. This has continued. The United States has withdrawn some of the sales that it has made to Saudi Arabia, but it continues with some others. So it isn't as if it has stopped the flow of weapons to Saudi Arabia, weapons that that country is using to attempt to destroy Yemen. So the United States is complicit in this, as it has been from the start. This is nothing new, just because it's a new administration. The Biden administration mirrors the policies in this regard of the Trump administration, of the Obama administration, of the Clinton, Bush, going all the way back decades. The United States is a war-making and war-mongering nation. It supports wars of its allies if it will in some way enhance its profits and power throughout the world. This hasn't changed with Biden. It won't change with Biden. It's tragic, but the Yemeni people are continuing to fight and will until they are free.
Observers believe the Biden administration can only show its seriousness in ending the conflict by placing additional pressure on the Saudis to cease the violence and seek a diplomatic solution. Whether or not the U.S. is willing to do that to its regional ally is anybody's guess.
Israel appears to be in the midst of another political deadlock after its fourth general election in less than 2 years. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's become Israel's longest-serving prime minister after 12 years in power, had hoped that this week's election would give him another term. He tried hard to unite a right-wing coalition behind him, but apparently that has not happened. The 71-year-old's right-wing bloc has once again failed to secure enough votes for a parliamentary majority. His bloc is 9 seats short of a necessary 61-seat threshold. It is now far from clear who would get the mandate to form the next cabinet. If he wants to stay in power, Netanyahu will probably have to build a coalition involving Jewish ultra-Orthodox and ultra-nationalist parties. Netanyahu may even have to seek the support of a Palestinian party, which in a surprise development has managed to win several seats. Meanwhile, Netanyahu's opponents who could somehow reach a parliamentary majority are far from united and are unlikely to be able to agree to cooperate. It is still too soon to know whether this election will prove to be inconclusive. If neither bloc succeeds, Israel could be headed for a fifth general election since 2019. Some analysts believe the regime is experiencing its worst political crisis in decades. The Israeli Prime Minister is in deep trouble because this week's election was widely viewed as a referendum on his leadership. Netanyahu's election campaign focused on his much-talked-about COVID-19 vaccination program and his push to normalize ties with some Arab states. But his opponents insist he mishandled the pandemic. Meanwhile, they argue that he should not remain in office while being tried on corruption charges. Netanyahu is the first incumbent Israeli prime minister to be indicted after being formally charged with corruption. He has denied any wrongdoing and insists that he will not try to block the trial. But critics are not buying that. They suspect that if he finally forms a parliamentary majority, he may seek action at the Knesset to delay or end the legal process.
If he can form a coalition government, he will certainly appoint someone as the attorney general who will quash the corruption charges against them. So, I mean, it's not simply the question of forming a government for him. It's a question for him of staying out of prison, because let's face it, Israeli police have been after him for some time, and they have enough evidence.
Meanwhile, as Israeli political parties wrangle over how to proceed from this point, Palestinians in the occupied territories are showing less interest in Israeli politics. This is perhaps because the Palestinian issue was not mentioned much during electoral campaigns by Israeli parties. The regime has been demolishing Palestinian homes, seizing their lands, and building on them over the past decades.
We're going to continue to see exactly what we have been seeing over the past years, and that is the continuation of a settlement expansion, the ousting of Palestinians from East Jerusalem, the continued dispossession of the Bedouin in the Negev.
This has been an unchanging policy, and no new cabinet is expected to halt that.
Back in 2018, Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist and critic of the Saudi government, was murdered after he entered Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Saudi Arabia initially denied any knowledge of Khashoggi's fate, as the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman told Bloomberg News that the journalist left the consulate shortly after he entered and that there is nothing to hide. However, recordings and other evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed how a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. In February, a long-awaited U.S. intelligence report also concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved and probably ordered the assassination of Khashoggi. But Washington stopped short of targeting bin Salman with financial or other sanctions. A report released in June 2019 by the UN Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard concluded that there was credible evidence that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and other senior officials were behind Khashoggi's assassination and called the murder an international crime. Lately, Callamard has revealed she was threatened by the Saudis for her role in the Khashoggi investigation. She said a colleague alerted her that a Saudi official had threatened to have her taken care of. The UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary, and Arbitrary Killings says the officials in the room had considered the remarks as a death threat. Calamard, who will this month take on her new post as the Secretary General of Amnesty International, had previously slammed the international community for their failure to ensure justice in Khashoggi's assassination.
Effectively, we see the United Nations is powerless because it is in the hand of the superpower, and particularly the United States, that has the veto decision on anything that goes against its own interests.
A declassified U.S. intelligence report revealed that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, had ordered the gruesome killing of Saudi opposition journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Biden administration only announced sanctions recently and visa bans on the citizens involved in Khashoggi's murder, but stopped short of imposing sanctions on the Crown Prince himself. That is while the U.S. President Joe Biden rejected the idea of holding bin Salman accountable for the murder. He stated that Washington has an alliance with Riyadh and cannot punish its head of state. Indeed, Washington's alliance with Riyadh is a lucrative one. The U.S. has accounted for 37% of global arms exports in the world between 2016 and 2020, making it the largest arms exporter in the last 5 years. A major chunk of that goes to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the biggest arms importer in the world and alone accounted for 24% of total U.S. arms exports during the same period. Weapons which have been used in Yemen war to kill thousands of innocent children and civilians and cause the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States is protecting Saudi Arabia violation of human rights and all genocidal crime that Saudi Arabia is doing, not only against the dissident, but also in Yemen.
The U.S. President Joe Biden has refused to penalize the Saudi Crown Prince, despite the fact that he promised to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state for Khashoggi's killing and other abuses during his 2020 presidential campaign. While the U.S. benefits from its lucrative alliance with the Saudis, seems that the green dollars have lured Washington to turn a blind eye to Riyadh's crimes.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.